U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Is a revolt brewing against ESG investing? Plus, voters parse Liz Cheney's loss in Wyoming and also the primary results from Alaska. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnists Kim Strassel and Alicia Finley. Let's start with the Journal's editorial on Tuesday under the headline, "The ESG Investing Backlash Arrives." But to lay some of the groundwork, ESG, of course, stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. And Alicia, can you give us a bit of a sense of what this movement is all about and how it has managed to sneak into the American economy with remarkably little debate or pushback?
This movement, the ESG, different people will define it in different ways, and that's part of the problem. But it's really kind of gained momentum over the last decade, and especially in the last few years, as asset managers and other financial institutions have realized that it's actually quite lucrative for them in terms of that they can brand something, brand an investment, brand a fund, mutual fund, or exchange-traded fund as ESG or sustainable and charge higher fees essentially for a similar product that's like an index fund. But it's also grown in tandem with this kind of progressive movement, progressive investing movement that believes that, you know, worker pension funds, foundation endowments could actually help serve social or environmental purpose and achieve these goals that they can't achieve through legislation per se. And I guess a classic case in point of this is the climate, in terms of a lot of these funds are now pushing companies, energy companies in particular, but others, to disclose their climate emissions and to set goals to reduce their climate emissions. Especially there's a movement for net zero in 2050, where asset managers are seeking to require companies to set goals to eliminate all their carbon emissions by the year 2050. There's also a component in which they're also trying to set quote-unquote human capital rules on these companies, and this would cover the gamut of, you know, requiring men and women to be paid equally, as well as requiring disclosures of the pay gaps between men and women, and increasingly setting gender diversity and racial quotas for corporate boards. That poses obviously constitutional problems when, you know, governments do it. But increasingly, these asset managers are voting against companies if they don't put, say, one or two women on a board, or one or two other racial minorities or gender minorities, someone from, you know, LGBTQ groups. So in many ways, this is the left trying to end run Congress and state legislatures. And I think you're starting to see a backlash, at least in Congress and the state legislatures, right now more so in the state legislature, as well as the attorneys generals, about this, about these asset managers essentially using worker funds in terms of the pension funds, but also more broadly other, you know, taxpayer dollars to promote these social objectives or cultural objectives.
But those social and cultural objectives, the HR aspects of ESG seem like their intention, at least sometimes with the environmental aspects. And I'll point to a controversy a couple months ago where Tesla, a maker of electric cars, was dropped from an ESG index, and ExxonMobil remained in the ESG index. And I'll read a section of the Wall Street Journal story on this. In an explanation of the move, the index operator said Tesla lagged its peers for a variety of reasons, including its carbon strategy, working conditions, and handling of a regulatory investigation, unquote. And Elon Musk, Tesla founder, his response to this was, ESG is a scam. It has been weaponized by phony social justice warriors. And I understand the point that he is making, Kim, because Tesla makes electric cars, which you would think would be a real high priority on the E side of ESG. But the index people are saying, well, look at the S and look at the G. It becomes pretty opaque pretty fast. And I grant that the index operator probably has some sort of rubric that they're relying on to make these decisions. But if you can tweak the S and the G and the E and make the rubric come out however you want, then what are we really doing here?
Right. The only thing that was missing from that explanation you gave was the words Elon Musk. And of course, he has become a little bit politically of a nuisance. nuisance to many on the left, and so they're out to get him. And this is the real problem. What we're talking about here is ESG is just another word for politicized investing. And as you note, Kyle, you can move around the matrix and the rubric, and you can come up with all sorts of justifications. But fundamentally, this is the left having taken hostage or won over a number of the prominent heads of some of these exchange-traded fund groups, other organizations, whether it's BlackRock or others, and then they get them to impose their agenda via the market, the agenda that they can't get through in Congress or elsewhere. And it fundamentally turns capitalism as we know it on its head, in that what we want here is investors loan money to companies on the grounds that they expect them to make a better mousetrap or provide better services, to hire some good employees, to make good products, and then to watch their costs, to make money, make a return, and spread that return back to investors. It's based on the profit motive. This is in turn saying you need to make your investment decisions and take your corporate actions based on the social good that we, the left, and we, the heads of some of these funds, say is the right thing to do. And if you don't, you'll get punished because we'll vote against you, we'll smear you in the press, we'll remove you from our funds, etc. And now we're starting to see some politicians and others, in particular a group of state attorneys general, who are really pushing back on this because their argument is, no, we have a lot of pension money invested with you folks, and you need to be focused on getting us the best financial returns, especially for our retirees.
And just to underline that point, I don't have a problem if any individual investor wants to make those decisions. If they like electric cars and they say, I'm dropping my Tesla investments because I don't like what Tesla is doing on the social side, or frankly, I just don't like Elon Musk, or any other reason. I mean, it's a free country and it's a free economy. The objection is to those kinds of choices being imposed on people who are not consciously making that decision, who are not choosing to maybe accept a lower financial return in exchange for a clean conscience on whatever your issue of the day is, whether it's people who have money in these pension funds. The other thing, Alicia, is that it seems like these options of ESG are also starting to make their way into the regulatory arena where the government is going to try to impose them. And one thing to keep an eye on is this Securities and Exchange Commission's plan to mandate disclosure of climate risks. Can you give us a sense of what the plan is, what's going on there?
So this is a rule that was proposed in March, but has been long in the works. It actually goes back to the Obama administration considered this, but decided that it didn't have the legal authority because Congress didn't give it. This rulemaking that Gensler, the chairman, has proposed would require companies across the economy to disclose their carbon emissions. I mean, that's the main part of it. But this would not just be limited to the carbon emissions that they produce. It could potentially be also include the what are known as scope 3 emissions. And that would cover the companies or suppliers and their customers. So for instance, ExxonMobil, disclosures wouldn't only cover how much it produces in, you know, refining or oil and gas production. These scope 3 emissions would also incorporate how much CO2 is emitted when, you know, people drive cars that burn Exxon's oil. It would also potentially include the plastic, how much CO2 is created when Exxon's liquefied natural gas, or rather natural gas liquids, are burned or used in plastics, and then how much is emitted when it degrades in the ground over decades. The broader problem with this is it also imposes liabilities on these companies, and which is why many companies are really pushing back. It's one thing for maybe perhaps some companies to be required to disclose, well, maybe they have a climate risk, or there's a risk if the government imposes a carbon tax, because that could increase their costs. And that would maybe be considered a material disclosure. But it's another thing for them to have to, or government requiring these companies, again, across the economy, to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions and quote-unquote climate risk from potential government policies, regardless of whether it really is material to their own business. And just to take an example, you know, an asset manager was telling me the other day, or was trying to argue, that Walmart's emissions are material because a customer in 10 years might step into a store and say that they want to know what Walmart's greenhouse gas emissions are. I'm very skeptical of that. And I think that is one of the reasons why this is going to be a very, the rule will be especially legally vulnerable to a challenge, is because it's so sweeping and isn't very narrowly tailored. The other reason, of course, that it could be subject to legal challenge is that Congress never explicitly granted this authority to regulate these disclosures. The Congress has granted SEC broad authority to promote, to issue rules that are in the public interest or in terms of capital formation and capital efficiency. And this is what the SEC is citing to force through this rule. But in that case, then the SEC can require the government or require companies to disclose almost anything, which also presents free or First Amendment issues here. One other thing I just wanted to circle back on, and there's a certain irony here. So the asset managers are pushing these SEC disclosures and actually supportive of them. But now the Gensler has actually also proposed a new rule that would require them to issue disclosures whenever they name a ESG fund or a sustainable fund, and would foist all kinds of new reporting requirements and liabilities on these now asset managers. And so there's a kind of a regulation for thee but not me component of this, where asset managers want to foist more regulations on other companies but want to dodge them themselves.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. One point that Alicia made before the break on this SEC climate disclosure regulation is that it might be vulnerable to a legal challenge. And Kim, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. In July, the journal had an op-ed, and it was co-written by a former member of the SEC. And it draws comparisons between the case that the Supreme Court decided this last year on the EPA's Clean Power Plan. And what the Supreme Court said there was that Congress never gave the EPA explicitly this power. And this is a major question for Congress to resolve. And so the EPA can't do it on its own. And do you think there's a comparison there with this SEC regulation, that the argument would be Congress never gave the SEC the authority to mandate that a retailer figure out its emissions up and down the supply chain?
Yeah, one of the things that that op-ed really made clear, at least for me, and I've got to wager other readers, is just how powerful and potentially consequential that West Virginia v. EPA decision is. Because the op-ed made the claim that the power grab that the EPA engaged in that particular situation with the Clean Power Plan is nearly indistinguishable from what the SEC is now attempting to do here on these disclosure rules. And it also made clear that the Supreme Court, in writing that decision, had clearly been on to all of the tricks that had increasingly been going on out in industry and in government with bureaucrats to essentially sidestep Congress. And it basically laid out a number of things that were red lines or problems that would allow the court to just say that something was a major question and therefore needed to be dealt with by Congress rather than allowing bureaucrats to do it instead. So, you know, one of it was, is how sweeping is it? Does it impose big changes across the economy? Clearly the SEC rule does that here. One is, does it lie beyond the expertise of the agency in question? There is little doubt that the SEC has no real experience in climate issues. Does it rely on some novel or new interpretation of longstanding statutes? That is what the SEC is doing here, looking back to 1930s laws, the Securities Act and the Securities Exchange Act as the basis for its power. And this is the part that always makes me smile, did Congress actually consider this and then decide not that it wasn't going to do it? And obviously that is the case here. So I think it made a very powerful case for why this SEC rule would be very vulnerable. But what I loved about this whole comparison is how it made clear that a lot of the regulations that the current administration are dreaming up are potentially something that could get targeted by this major questions doctrine in the court.
So, Alicia, we'll give you the last word on this topic. You've been covering this ESG stuff for a long while. I mean, how significant do you think that this backlash is turning out to be? And there's a recent letter from 19 state attorneys general to the asset manager BlackRock. And one line of it is they say, based on the facts currently available to us, BlackRock appears to use the hard-earned money of our state citizens to circumvent the best possible return on investment as well as their vote, unquote. And a letter like that from 19 attorneys general seems to me like a pretty big deal. I don't know about you.
Right. So I think the issue here, or where they really have power, is in terms of investigation and potentially filing lawsuits against the asset managers such as BlackRock, but also Vanguard, for potentially abusing, you know, antitrust or laws, or violating antitrust laws in terms of essentially colluding across the economy to impose these requirements that we mentioned earlier on companies. I'm a little skeptical that the politicians or the AGs themselves can actually create any change in terms of the financial incentives or are actually going to lead to an exodus from these funds. They manage trillions and trillions. You know, BlackRock has over $10 trillion in assets under its management. It does produce pretty good, solid returns for its customers. More broadly speaking, it's really the pension funds, the government worker pension funds, not the AGs, and even in most cases, not even the state treasurers who control the money. And the state pension funds and local pension funds are actually very in bed with the progressives here. And they've really actually been, especially out in California, CalSTRS, but also CalPERS, have been really pushing this ESG investing and been aligned with BlackRock and the other asset managers on this. So the money, I'm not sure that there's going to be a huge backlash in terms of money shifting out of these funds. I mean, we'll see. But I'm more optimistic that the state attorneys generals could, and potentially if a Republican wins the White House in 2024, you may see some movement on that front in the FTC or even the other executive agencies trying to really crack down on asset managers that are violating their fiduciary duty to their customers.
Finally, the big election news on Tuesday was, as expected, in Wyoming, Harriet Hageman has won the primary there for the House race. 66%. She'll be the Republican nominee in November and very likely the next congresswoman from Wyoming. Liz Cheney coming in at about 29%, so less than half of the vote of her competitor there. Let's listen to a clip of Harriet Hageman on election night.
She's not focusing on Wyoming. She's not focusing on our issues. She's still focusing on an obsession about President Trump. And the citizens of Wyoming, the voters of Wyoming, sent a very loud message tonight. We have spoken, and that is not what we are interested in terms of our lone congressional representative. Wyoming is entitled to have a representative that represents our interests, that listens to us, that addresses our issues. That isn't Liz Cheney, and the fact that that's where she went back to with her speech tonight, I think demonstrates that she really isn't listening to Wyoming now. She hasn't for quite some time, and that's why we needed to replace her.
And here's a piece of that speech from Liz Cheney conceding.
2 years ago, I won this primary with 73% of the vote. I could easily have done the same again. The path was clear. But it would have required that I go along with President Trump's lie about the 2020 election. It would have required that I enable his ongoing efforts to unravel our democratic system and attack the foundations of our republic. That was a path I could not and would not take.
Kim, what do you make of this? I mean, I guess my thought is that she's right, that she could have easily won that primary had she minded her Trumpian P's and Q's, I suppose. So maybe the pessimistic view is that these stolen election claims have such a grip on the party. The optimistic view might be that Liz Cheney and the January 6th committee also did other things to alienate Republican voters. The January 6th committee, remember, just to pick one thing, has leaked text messages from Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, which has very little, to my eye, to do with anything related to the investigation or the riot on January 6th. And so maybe there's a little bit of truth in both of those stories.
Yeah, I don't put it as starkly as Liz Cheney would put it there. I think that Liz Cheney could have won her renomination without buying into crazy election claims. There are a lot of Republicans out there who have done that. You know, look at Glenn Youngkin. He is currently the head of Virginia, the new governor. And there's also been plenty of primaries where you don't necessarily have candidates that have been all in on, you know, the wildest of election claims, and they managed to succeed. The issue here for Cheney, I think, was in part what Hageman did describe. I think there were a lot of Wyoming residents who they do only have one representative there, and they really want that person to be focused on their issues, which includes some of the biggest fights going on right now over energy production, etc. Liz Cheney made a decision very early on that she was going to stake everything on this question of the January 6th committee, try to make this a referendum on the issue, and that ended up failing. And, you know, the fact that this was clear, she has already filed to transfer some of her campaign funds into a new political super PAC, which she's going to call, at least for now, the Great Task. And that Great Task, as she defined it in her speech, was doing whatever necessary to make sure Donald Trump isn't reelected president. And that is absolutely entirely her right. But I think this was a question of Wyoming deciding whether or not they wanted a congressperson that was going to be solely focused on that over the next 2 years or on Wyoming issues.
The other notable thing that Cheney said is she said in that concession speech, now the real work begins. And she also confirmed recently that she is actually thinking about running for president in 2024. And it raises an interesting question whether this split could cost the Republican Party in 2024, maybe the presidential election. And I don't expect, Alicia, that anything, those kind of considerations would dissuade President Trump from running. But do you think that if Liz Cheney makes clear that she would run against him as an independent candidate, try to siphon enough votes to stop him from getting a second term in the White House, that might sway some Republican voters in the Republican primary?
Well, I think it would be largely a kamikaze mission here. I mean, potentially she could siphon off some votes, though the people who are more inclined to vote for her may also not be inclined to vote for Trump regardless and be more inclined to vote for a Democrat or vote at all. There's also the last time a third party candidate actually gained a lot of ground was in 1992, Ross Perot, and he arguably did cost George Bush the election. If Cheney were to run and mount a bid in 2024, I think that it would be self-defeating to herself. It'd be self-defeating to the Republican Party and the country, because there is the potential that she would hand the election to Democrats or a Democratic candidate in 2024, who would just continue to impose the kinds of policies Biden has been. And if Biden will run again, he's now sending indications that he plans to. But someone who may replace him, Kamala Harris, potential Elizabeth Warren, others who want the job, would likely be even more progressive. So I think she needs to think hard about whether she really wants to essentially blow up the Republican Party, divide the country more, and do essentially what Donald Trump did with the Georgia elections 2 years ago, essentially in sabotaging Republicans and handing an election to the Democrats.
A couple of last thoughts here on the results from Alaska, and let's start with the ranked choice voting for the U.S. House seat. And there the results are interesting and pretty close. So right now, the Democrat is in first with about 38%. That's Mary Peltola. And then the two Republican candidates. And remember how this works. The ranked choice voting system works. If nobody gets over 50%, the lowest candidate is eliminated, and then all of those voters are reshuffled to their second or third choice. And what's interesting here is that the candidate currently in second is Sarah Palin with 32% of the vote, and then third is Nick Begich with about 29% of the vote. And it goes to show the issues with ranked choice voting. I should say that there's only about 70% of the vote reported. There's still a lot coming in, so those rankings could change. But it goes to show the strategic problems that ranked choice voting, I think, raise. Because if you assume that a lot of those Democrats would prefer not to be represented by Sarah Palin, then if Nick Begich gets eliminated first here, then maybe they would have been better off, Kim, if they had not voted for the Democratic candidate. Because if he's the first one eliminated, then their second chance votes don't get a chance to be reallocated to him.
Yeah, this was something that the Republican side were also very concerned about. Because think about this, there was always a very strong possibility that the Democrat would come in first because you had two Republicans that were going to split the vote in what is a pretty Republican state. And so it was fascinating. The Republican Party of Alaska spent some real money and time trying to educate Republican voters. They had a slogan. They said, rank the red, meaning you were going to walk into the ballot box and you were going to see two Republicans. They were very concerned that some Alaskans, especially Republican Alaskans, were so angry over this ranked voting system that they would only put down the one person they wanted to win and not go through the rest of the ranking process. And so the GOP was trying to explain to people, don't do that because there's a potential that after the first round, a Republican can get eliminated. And therefore, it's very important that you have ranked the other Republicans so that they come in on top over the Democrat. I mean, the whole thing is such a kind of strategic nightmare for voters. And there were a lot of reports of Alaskans being very bitter about this whole process, not to mention the fact that they've now got this long system where no one is even going to find out the results there until September. So a lot could still change. And then remember, this is simply the final vote for a special election to fill out the rest of Don Young's seat for a few months. Alaskans get to go do this whole ranked choice voting system again in November with the results of the primaries for all the other seats and for the full term of Don Young.
The other sort of odd result that strikes me is in the U.S. Senate race, and there the top vote getter in the primary is Senator Lisa Murkowski with about 44% of the vote, and Republican challenger with about 40% of the vote. And in the primary, there were all sorts of minor candidates, but nobody above single digits. And remember how Alaska's system now works. The top four vote getters in the primary move on to the general election. And so it seems odd to me, why would anybody bother voting in the primary if they're going to just rerun the election with these same two major Republican candidates in November?
Yeah, it's kind of nuts, especially because you're basically going to rerun it with those top two candidates, with the added complexity of a ranked choice system in which who knows how voters will allocate in their second or third or fourth choices those single digit candidates that came in. And, you know, as we were mentioning yesterday on the podcast, this just kind of goes to show the silliness of this ranked choice system and some of the real flaws of it. I think what these results show, because this was a real race between Lisa Murkowski, the incumbent, and Kelly Sabaka, who's challenging her, and you know, they both end up with more than 40% of the vote. They're very, very narrowly divided. If this had been a straight up Republican primary, Murkowski might be facing some accountability from Republican voters who are unhappy with her. These results clearly show Murkowski benefiting from a lot of Democrats who came to vote for her in the election. And then there'll be all manner of gaming out how that works come the November election with this new ranked choice system. Some interesting reports recently, by the way, too, that while she didn't publicly comment on this, as Alaskans were going through their initiative battle over whether or not to change the voting system, some Murkowski people were caught on record saying that it certainly benefited her. And that, I think, is also fed into some Alaskan sort of skepticism about why they are being put through this process.
Thank you, Kim and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button. And we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.